So we're reading from the first letter of Paul to the Corinthians. If I speak in tongues of mortals and of angels, but I do not have love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but I do not have love, I am nothing. If I give away all my possessions, and if I hand over my body so that I may boast, but I do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient, love is kind, love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but it rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things.
Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Luke. Jesus began to speak in the synagogue at Nazareth. Today, he said, the scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. And all spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his mouth. They said, "Is not this Joseph's son?" And he said to them, "Doubtless you will quote to me this proverb, 'Doctor, cure yourself,' and you will say, 'Do here also in your hometown the things that we have heard you do at Capernaum.'" And he said, "Truly, I tell you, no prophet is accepted in the prophet's hometown. But the truth is, there were many widows in Israel at the time of Elijah, when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months, and there was a severe famine over the land. Yet Elijah was sent to none of them except to a widow at Zarephath in Sidon. There were also many lepers in Israel in the time of the prophet Elisha, and none of them was cleansed except Naaman the Syrian." And when they heard this, all in the synagogue were filled with rage. They got up, drove him out of the town, led him to the brow of the hill on which their town was built, so that they might hurl him off the cliff. But he passed through the midst of them and went on his way. The Gospel of the Lord. So today's gospel reading is as good an example of magical thinking as you can find in the scriptures. At the end of the story, when the author tells us that they were going to haul him to the cliff and throw him over the edge of it, and by the way, in the ancient tradition, in the Jewish tradition, this was a precursor to stoning, so they would have thrown the person over the cliff and then buried them with rocks and whatnot to kill them. And it was their way of meting out, or one of the ways that they would mete out justice in the ancient Jewish community. By the way, crucifixion was not one of those means. You understand that, right? That crucifixion was the Roman form of torture and execution. Okay, and then what the author tells us is that he slipped through the crowd, woo, like a ghost. And this is as good a time as any to remind you folks, and I will remind you again and again and again, as this year unfolds, that these stories in the Gospels, all four of the Gospels, and, by the way, all of the Scriptures, these are not history. They were never meant to be history. These stories, the poetry, all the stuff that you find in the scriptures, both the Jewish scriptures and the Christian scriptures, are memory. They are not history. I'm going to repeat this again. And as much as anything, these stories and these scenes reflect the concerns, the prejudices, the fears, and the agendas of these ancient authors and these ancient communities. So, with that in mind, I gotta ask you the question. So, why were his homeboys and girls enraged to the point of wanting to chuck him off the cliff? Sandy? Spoke a truth they didn't want to hear. Okay, a little warm. Anybody else? You are wise not to respond, because you could tell right away this was a trick question, and I'm going to give you the trick answer. And by the way, one of the other clues to the nature of these stories in the Gospels and again throughout the Scriptures is that if you actually check the geography of this story, and if anybody besides me has been to the ancient town of Nazareth in the north around the Sea of Galilee, anybody else beside me been there? Guess what? They ain't no hill. And there is no cliff within miles of this ancient city. And so this author is making this scene up. Like many things in the Scriptures, these ancient ones, they didn't care about the accuracy of the stories. Again, this is not history. This is not the recording of some dude running around with a GoPro on his mountain bike helmet, okay? You know, taking photos of Jesus. This was written in the second century, probably the middle of the second century of the Common Era, a good 100 years removed from the time of Jesus. And this is their collective memory. Keep that in mind. So, back to the question. Why enraged to the point of throwing him off the cliff? Sandy guessed was because he told him the truth. It's even worse than that, Sandy. He retells a couple of stories from their ancient tradition of both Elijah and his protege, Elisha, and basically spins the stories to make it abundantly clear to his homeboys and homegirls that healing is coming to the people of God, but not to them. What? I mean, that would be like somebody, well, that would be like Jesus showing up here. Let's say he walks through one of the parish hall doors. Everybody goes, oh, wait, everybody wave to Jesus. And then he announces to us, the whole world's going to get saved except for you. Or somebody bangs on your front door at your house and announces that same message. Your whole neighborhood is going to be made whole by the presence and the power of God, except for you. Tell me your response. Yeah. I mean, he's goading them, for God's sake. He's asking for it. I mean, why would he do this, right? And it's not very open table, says Chuck. That's right. It's not very, you know, it's not very liberal of him, is it? Well, at this particular point, he knows where his next meal isn't coming from. Let's put it that way. Yeah, not home. He's got a skedaddle. It's such a weird scene, and especially following last week's, where, you know, he's come to his hometown, everybody's excited. Imagine his mom would say, that's my boy. And he gets up in the synagogue, and they open the scroll, but he draws from three different portions of Isaiah. There's no way he would have read it. He would have recited it from memory as though, you know, he owned these three passages, basically, again, you know, proclaiming healing and wholeness to a people whose lives are being taken apart at the seams by Imperial Rome, well into the fourth century of the Common Era. And it's happening as this story is being put to papyrus in the second century of the Common Era. They are being hunted down, they are being tortured, they are being killed. And they're looking around going, okay, the followers of Jesus, we all have a target on our back as far as Imperial Rome is concerned, but you know, all these Jewish folk where we came from, I mean, there's a whole bunch of us that are Gentile now, we got a target on our back, but these Jewish folk, they got a big target on their back. So we want to be separated from them as much as is humanly possible. Oh no, that's not us, say the followers of Jesus. Again, Imperial Rome is doing what imperial powers have done since Roman times, which is divide and conquer and basically coerce people to do things they don't want to do. And it's been happening on this planet ever since. So, weird, weird scene. And I challenge anybody to come up with a real good explanation for why Jesus would goad them the way he does. And the story is told and then dropped like a hot rock. I mean, never comes up again, and there's some possibility, although it's pretty slim possibility. Some would say, oh, you know, this is, you know, again, Jesus saying, oh, all you Jewish people, like he's not Jewish, right? Oh, all you Jewish people, you don't get the cookies and milk anymore from God. That's for us now. I don't think that's what's going on, but unfortunately, by the fourth century of the Common Era, as this story is retold again and again and again, or read again and again, it becomes the seedbed for anti-Semitism among the followers of Jesus, particularly when Christianity is named the religion of the empire and begins to take on the trappings of imperial power. Things get weird, things get ugly, and they've remained so ever since, unfortunately. So, you know, we're left with this weird scene. And here's what you're getting out of that. A lot of us have grown up in less than healthy settings. These days, we like to refer to our families and the places where we grew up as dysfunctional, right? And I'm now wondering, having got to know folks here and around the community, if there's anyone who hasn't been exposed to some dysfunctional system of some kind. Anybody? Anybody want to claim that? Even if you did, you wouldn't admit it, would you? You know, Brian? Yeah. Hold that thought. Because Brian wanted to know where the functional one is, and we're going to talk about that. So, one of the unfortunate outcomes of living in dysfunction is that the dysfunction gets lodged inside of us. And I would love to stand before you today and tell you this is not the case, that, you know, we move through our teen years and we do our rebellion and all that fun stuff, and then we become adults and it all just evaporates and goes away. Yay! And we're all grown up and mature and all that good stuff. And it doesn't work that way. Whatever dysfunction we were raised in, we just bring it right with us. And the way it plays out, as I've been taught to understand, is in this nasty little triangle that is, oh wait, that's not it. That's the cool triangle. Sorry. Where did that come from? That was not me. All right. I don't know. It's this one right here. This triangle. Perpetrator, victim, and rescuer. Anybody familiar with this triangle? Okay, thought so. For those who are not, let me explain. Most dysfunctional systems, be they family, sometimes it's school, could be a work setting, could be any number of things. You've got someone who's doing something they should not be doing, coercing others. So in the case of a family, it could be someone in the family engaged in some form of abuse. Could be any, you know, it could be their drinking or their drug addiction, and all the whole time they're saying, well, it's my body, it's my life, I can do what I want. And it's shredding the family. You know, and that person, that alcoholic or that addict becomes perpetrator. Of course, you know, you get enough alcohol in somebody and they're no longer responsible for their actions, and so maybe they're involved in physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, verbal, you name it, some form of abuse. And, oh, by the way, there's this thing known as institutional abuse. We'll talk about that in a second. So in a dysfunctional system, you've got a perpetrator which creates a victim who needs desperately a rescuer. And so you'll have various members of the family, for instance, in this kind of family. You got a perpetrator, the kids, maybe the wife ends up a victim, and then someone, usually one of the kids, becomes the rescuer. That was not me growing up in my alcoholic household. I was the black sheep of the family. It was my younger brother who became the rescuer. He was the one that was going to make it all better in the family in the face of mom's drinking and violent behavior. And so you, growing up in a system like this, we bring it into our adult life. And we envision the world from the vantage point of this triangle. In any situation, regardless of where it is, home, neighborhood, school, work, the gas line at Costco, it doesn't matter. Somebody's going to be a perpetrator, somebody is going to be a victim, and somebody is going to be a rescuer, whether they want to or not. And we frame the world from this point of view. And there comes a time for, maybe not all of us, but some of us, we hit the wall on this. I certainly did, right about the age of 30, and began to awaken to the world, having participated fully in this nasty little triangle for the first 30 years of my life, and said, I'm exhausted. I don't want to do this anymore. There's gotta be a different way to get through the day. With no sense of what that might look like. And thank God, under the guidance of my spiritual director and others like him, began to explore a different way of moving through the day than this. And if I didn't mention it before, let me say it now. These are interchangeable roles. So one day in the dysfunctional system, you can be the perpetrator. Another day, you can be the victim. Another day, you can be the rescuer. And if you're really on a roll, you can have a day where you end up all three, you know, changing out, depending on who you're with and what's going on, right? And we become adept at swapping out in these roles. And unfortunately, the church, beginning in the 4th century of the Common Era, bought into this way of getting through the day. And by the Middle Ages, the church had developed a theology rooted in this sickness. And let's be clear, this is a sickness. It's a relational sickness that we're describing. And the theology would sound something like, who's the perpetrator? Come on, bring it. You guys know this. Some of you grew up with it. Satan. Did I hear Satan? Satan. And who's the victim? You. And who's the rescuer? Jesus. Woo! And there comes a time, folks, we just got to drop the rock and stop playing this head game, because it is destructive at its core. Unfortunately, what I just described is what we now know to be popular Christianity, yes? And so you and I are invited to imagine a different way of getting through the day. And unfortunately, the church became adept at this particular approach to life. Again, sometimes we, as kids, we were told by the Monsignor that we were the perpetrators because we were full of sin, never to be anything other than, you know, black stains on the face of the earth, and that somebody else was going to end up victimized, you know, by our sin. And Jesus would probably, although in the Catholic tradition, didn't talk too much about Jesus. That gets messy, right? You know, God would rescue other people from our horrible... I mean, there's lots of different ways to spin this, is where I'm going with that. So much so that most of the classic theories of atonement are rooted in this. In this crazy way of getting through the day. Jesus died for our sins. Lord God. Time to stop. Take a breath and imagine a different way of framing our understanding of who we are, who God is. I mean, again, at some point in some classic medieval theology, God is the perpetrator. Jesus is the victim, right? And who knows who the rescuer is. I hope you can see how insane that theology is and how destructive it remains in our tradition. So, what do you say we say sayonara to that approach to the Christian tradition and imagine a different way of getting through the day? Well, it just so happens that Jeannie, who is one of our newer lay readers, give it up for Jeannie Johnson. She did a great job this morning. Thank you. She shared with us a portion of the letter from Paul to the people of Corinth, where after wrangling with them about gifts and they're all arguing about all this stuff, he says, oh, by the way, there's a bigger way. There's a bigger way to roll. And he starts talking about love, right? Let's call it compassion, just so that we don't confuse it with romantic love. And I had Jeannie stop before we went through all 13 verses so as not to kick into, oh my gosh, let's have a wedding. Yay! Let's read all 13 verses of chapter 13 of the first letter of the people of Corinth. And the greatest of these is love. Oh, it's so romantic. Ah! We stopped. We avoided that black hole. In order to understand that what Paul is really talking about to the people of Corinth and then extending this message to us is, imagine using compassion and engaging a compassionate life to break this triangle. What that requires, as I've been taught, is to wake up every morning, to say my prayers, to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, and not the perpetrator God, and not the victim Jesus, and not the rescuer whatever, but to the God who has extended compassion, compassionate love, and distributive justice to all of creation, that God, which by the way is the one we worship here at St. Peter's, to say our prayers, give ourselves over to that compassionate God, and then choose to live a life today of compassion, and to recognize that it's a choice that you and I make. And when we choose to extend compassion to any and all, this is where it gets sticky, folks, and this is where it gets a little weird, and this is where we start asking questions about the rules. Yeah, but what about the perpetrator? I mean, do we have to extend compassion to the perpetrator? I'll leave that one to you. But when we practice compassion, when we engage what I've come to think of as the discipline of compassion, and choose to extend that to any and all, including all of creation, one by one, one relationship at a time, one situation at a time, one day at a time, we break this. We break the cycle. Now, you folks, I'm sure, can think of all kinds of, I mean, the world is full of this. I mean, this is, you know, this is how the world, in one sense, has been ordered. Based on our brilliant ideas and hard-won wisdom, you know. The latest example as a culture is in here now in the United States, who's the perpetrator? Immigrants. Immigrants have now been named as the perpetrator. We have one in our midst. She's flown under the radar, but we know where she comes from. Still an immigrant. And who's the victim? The victim is all us white people. I mean, let's be crystal clear about how the victim is portrayed, right? So all whites in the United States. And who is the rescuer? The government! Woo! I mean, it's the same nasty cycle, just packaged in a whole different way. And you, again, can think of example after example of how this insidious system has penetrated every part of our common life, from home to school to work to community to state to nation to world. And you and I are invited to do what perhaps is the hardest thing on the planet to do, and that is recognize all of the ways in which we've participated in this and probably will continue to, because it's so familiar, and take up the invitation of the gospel to say, no, today we're going to try a different way. We're going to experiment with a different way of getting through the day, and we're going to try the discipline of compassion, just to see where it takes us. And all of that fueled by the grace of the God that we worship here at St. Peter's. So, class, is there any questions? Yeah, where's the functional family? Anybody want to tackle that one? Anybody want to... Yeah, it probably is a rhetorical question. Yeah, I don't know. Define. Well, he said functional. He didn't say normal. No one here would know anything about normal, I don't think. But functional, you know, I don't know. Maybe the answer is...
Is an adjustment.
Yes. Right. Yeah, good point. Chuck said dysfunction is an adjustment in order to be able to function. I mean, and as we engage the dysfunction as kids, it's called survival skills, right? That then become something else once we're adults. So yeah. And maybe it's what we aspire to here at St. Peter's. I mean, when we talk about being a community of compassion, I don't know about functional families, but you know, maybe this is as close as we're going to get. What Sandy said was that functional is the abnormal, and dysfunctional is the normal. I think you may be onto something there. And again, I think that's why the gospel and the teachings of Jesus are such an enormous challenge for folks like you and me, even to this day. Even the church hasn't figured this out yet. I mean, again, look at our history. We're the dysfunctional institution of the planet when it comes to, you know, life like this. So, again, it's an enormous challenge for us as people who follow Jesus. Yeah, Cecil? Yes. Well, it starts here, right? It starts with me, it starts with you, it starts with our willingness to do our work, to recognize, you know, where we come from and all the ways that this has, you know, become a part of our way of life. And then, again, we say our prayers, we give ourselves, we surrender. We come out with our hands up. And give ourselves to God, who would have us live in a very different way, and then begin to explore that alternate approach to life, which is the discipline of compassion. So yeah, it starts here, it starts at home. And then hopefully it kind of filters out as we go. Who knows? I mean, that's, what else can you do? Sharon? We have, as a congregation, we have certainly had our history of dysfunction. No question about it. Anybody who's been around for any length of time, and again, you know, we throw ourselves on the mercy of God, who would have us live in a very different way. So take that home with you. I'm going to get this out of the way so that Joan and Virginia can see the screen, and we will carry on. So take a nice deep breath.